From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The most important thing to think about in Darfur right now is that even though there is a peace agreement out there, only one of three main rebel factions has signed it. In addition, there's no security on the ground to enforce that peace agreement. That security is allegedly going to come from United Nations troops. However, the Sudanese government has always resisted these troops and has yet to agree to them.
Newsday correspondent Tina Sussman is back from 5 weeks in Sudan. We'll also speak with representatives of the two main rebel groups in Darfur. One has signed the peace deal, one has refused. Then investigative reporter Greg Palast on his new book, Armed Madhouse. Its subtitle, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and other dispatches from the front lines of the class war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is planning to deploy thousands of National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexican border to help keep out undocumented immigrants. Bush is expected to make the announcement tonight during a rare primetime address from the Oval Office. On Sunday, Mexican President Vicente Fox called Bush to express concern over what he calls the militarization of the border. White House officials have said the deployment is a temporary measure to give the government time to hire private contractors to support Border Patrol. In Haiti, René Préval has been sworn in as the country's first democratically elected president since the U.S.-backed coup that ousted Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004. At his inauguration ceremony, Préval urged Haitians to work together to build a more stable nation.
I will respect the rights of all Haitians, and I will make everyone respect those rights. I will do all I can so that the people of Haiti always remain a great people and the masters of their territory, and so that they never lose the smallest piece of their country.
René Préval previously served as Haiti's president from 1996 to 2001. He also served as prime minister in Aristide's first administration. The charity group Christian Aid is warning global warming could have a devastating effect on the continent of Africa. A new report by the group estimates 184 million people could die in Africa this century as a result of climate-induced floods, famine, drought, and conflict. The group said, quote, poor people will take the brunt, so we're calling on rich countries to help them adjust as the seas rise, the deserts expand, and floods and hurricanes become more frequent and intense. The Justice Department has asked a federal judge to throw out a lawsuit against AT&T over the company's role in the National Security Agency's warrantless domestic surveillance program. In court papers, federal officials argued whether the operations were legal or not, the program involves secrets too sensitive for public discussion. Meanwhile, the telecom giant Verizon has been sued for giving the NSA the phone records of millions of Americans. The lawsuit was filed Saturday, just days after USA Today reported Verizon, Bell South, and AT&T handed over millions of phone call records to help the government build the world's largest database. The 1986 Electronic Communications Privacy Act made it illegal for telephone companies and computer service providers to give the government records showing who their customers had dialed or emailed. Attorneys say that under the 86 law, the telecoms could be forced to pay out $1,000 per violation per customer. Meanwhile, U.S. spy operations are also making headlines in Europe. A Swedish newspaper is reporting that a new European Union law may allow the U.S. government to access information on phone calls, text messages, and emails sent by EU citizens. The new law, which goes into effect next year, requires European telephone operators and internet service providers to store information on who called whom and who emailed whom for at least 6 months. In Iraq, a U.S. military helicopter was shot down Sunday just south of Baghdad. Two soldiers died. Meanwhile, a series of bombings across Iraq killed at least 47 people Sunday. Among the targets were six Shiite shrines in the city of Bakuba. In other news from Iraq, the Hartford Courant reports the U.S. military has routinely deployed soldiers with known mental problems to fight in Iraq. The paper said a record 22 U.S. troops committed suicide in Iraq last year. In several cases, soldiers remained on active duty even after they attempted suicide. In Washington, peace campaigner Cindy Sheehan spent Mother's Day in an anti-war vigil outside the White House, along with actress Susan Sarandon and other military mothers and Iraq War vets. On Friday, federal agents raided the home and office of Dusty Fogo, who up until last week was the third highest-ranking official at the CIA. The raids came at a week after CIA Director Porter Goss unexpectedly resigned. It was Goss who promoted Fogo to become the CIA's executive director 2 years ago. Fogo is suspected of being part of a congressional bribery scandal that also involved jailed Republican Congressmember Duke Cunningham and the defense contractor Brent Wilkes. Fogo and Wilkes have been close friends for decades. According to the San Diego Union-Tribune, Wilkes received many secret black budget contracts from the CIA that are hidden from public scrutiny. Wilkes has also been accused of providing prostitutes at the Watergate and Westin hotels in D.C. to lawmakers in an effort to win contracts. In Europe, a group of Latin American leaders met with their European counterparts at a summit this weekend in Vienna. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez announced he wants to offer low-income Europeans discounted heating oil next winter. Chavez also predicted the end of what he described as the American empire.
The American empire is in a stage preceding death. As Mao Zedong would say, this is an empire made of paper. That's what it is, an empire made of paper. And we will rip it off and throw it away. Then the ashes of the empire will bring back the land of Abraham Lincoln.
The summit in Vienna was later disrupted by a Greenpeace activist from Argentina who pushed her way into a photo shoot of the world leaders. The woman, who was wearing a bikini, carried a sign protesting the construction of a pulp mill on the Argentine-Uruguayan border. The International Committee of the Red Cross is accusing the Bush administration of ignoring requests from the organization to have access to detainees being held in secret U.S. jails around the world. The U.S. has disappeared an unknown number of people captured in the so-called war on terror. The government refuses to reveal where they are held or to allow anyone, including attorneys, to see them. This is Red Cross spokesperson Vincent Lusser.
Well, indeed, states can detain people for imperative reasons of security, but whatever the legitimate reason for detaining people, we think there is no right to keep them in places that are unknown and to deny that they're being detained. So what we wish is to be notified of the people captured or arrested and then to get standard ICRC access to these people as we do for people in Guantanamo and Bagram.
In the West Bank town of Jenin, thousands of Palestinians gathered today for the funeral of seven Palestinians killed by Israeli forces Sunday. Among the dead was a leading militant from the group Islamic Jihad, who was accused of being connected to last month's suicide bombing in Tel Aviv that killed 11 people. Meanwhile, Israel's high court has upheld a controversial law that can block Palestinian residents of the West Bank or Gaza Strip from moving to Israel in order to live with their spouse, even if their spouse has Israeli citizenship. In Brazil, more than 50 people, including dozens of police officers, have died after one of the country's largest gangs launched a series of attacks targeting police stations, military facilities, and prison outposts. The uprising began Thursday after the Brazilian government announced the transfer of several imprisoned gang leaders. Rebellions were also reported in 40 prisons. Police said prisoners were holding about 230 prison guards hostage. This is the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
If we want to end this violence with the criminals and these organizations, we need to invest in education. That is the best weapon to create fewer gangs and more doctors.
In news from Washington, First Lady Laura Bush said Sunday she doesn't believe the public opinion polls that show her husband is one of the least popular presidents of the last 50 years. On Friday, a Harris poll put the president's approval rating at a new low of 29%. Laura Bush told Fox News, quote, "I don't really believe those polls. As I travel around the United States, I see a lot of appreciation for him. A lot of people come up to me and say, stay the course." In New York, a popular disc jockey working for Clear Channel has been arrested on charges of endangering the welfare of a child. The DJ, known as Star, threatened on air to sexually abuse the 4-year-old daughter of a rival radio personality. He also offered listeners $500 for information on where the 4-year-old goes to school. In addition, he made anti-Asian slurs about the girl's mother. Up until last week, Star co-hosted the popular syndicated morning show Star and Buck Wild. Clear Channel fired him Wednesday, but only after a member of the New York City Council took issue with the broadcast. In southern Utah, scores of protesters gathered Saturday to protest the government's plan to set off 700 tons of explosives next month in Nevada test site. The explosion will be 50 times more powerful than the Army's largest conventional bomb. Although the test, known as the Divine Strike, will use conventional explosives, it's being conducted in order to better understand nuclear bunker buster bombs. According to government documents, the test is needed to determine the, quote, proper nuclear yield necessary to destroy underground facilities. The Pentagon estimates the blast will be so large it'll create a 10,000-foot-high mushroom cloud. Critics fear the dust could spread radioactive particles from old nuclear tests. In education news, an adjunct professor at Boston College has resigned to protest the school's decision to award Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice an honorary degree. In a letter to the school's president, Professor Steve Almond said Rice has, quote, lied to the American people knowingly, repeatedly, in an effort to justify a pathologically misguided foreign policy, he wrote. And senior Army officials have withdrawn their support for a new HBO documentary filmed inside an Army combat hospital in Baghdad. The Secretary of the Army, Francis Harvey, and other senior Army officials were originally planning to attend a screening tonight of the film Baghdad ER in Washington, D.C. But they've decided the film's graphic footage might demoralize soldiers and negatively affect public opinion about the war. Last week, the Army's chief surgeon issued a memo warning medical staff at Army posts across the country to prepare for a possible influx of soldiers and families seeking comfort and counseling after watching the documentary. This is an excerpt of Baghdad ER, a warning for our television audience. The footage may disturb some viewers.
Oh, we're just putting a fix here. We put some pins up here and pins down there. It's connected with bars, and that helps just stabilize the fracture. Years ago, you just put a cast on him. The leg would flop around. It'd be uncomfortable. And we got a device like this, and it really makes things a lot easier when you're transporting a patient.
The patient's name is Sean Broder. He's turned 21 yesterday. He was at the PX and suffered a blast injury at Camp Victory. They took out a piece of the bowel, small, and now they're just looking for some more nicks.
This guy's birthday was yesterday. His 21st birthday. Hell of a way to celebrate, huh?
Well, he will get a Purple Heart for this injury. Yeah, it just, I mean, the problem is you'll have these little tiny holes. It looks like a mosquito bite almost. And then you'll think, well, that can't be that bad. And then it turns out it's hit their carotid and they're going to bleed to death. These little shrapnel wounds will just go, they'll just go everywhere.
Baghdad ER was produced by John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill of Downtown Community Television here in New York at the Firehouse. The documentary will air on HBO on May 21st. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we begin today's segments, taking an in-depth look at the ongoing crisis in Sudan. It's been 3 years and 3 months since the war erupted in Darfur, which is an isolated region in western Sudan. As many as 400,000 people have died in the region. As many as 3 million have been left homeless. The United Nations has labeled the conflict one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Congress and President Bush have declared the Darfur killings genocide. On May 5th, the Sudan government and one of the three rebel groups signed a U.S.-brokered peace agreement, but experts say the plan is rife with problems and it's unclear if the plan will be effective at all. The ceasefire officially went into effect Monday. The African Union, which brokered the deal, held a meeting today of its Peace and Security Council in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa to try to get the other two rebel groups to sign the agreement. Newsday correspondent Tina Sussman recently spent 5 weeks in Sudan looking at the devastation caused. Her series of reports is called Darfur Inside the Crisis, began running in Newsday on Sunday. Tina Sussman joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Well, talk about what you saw in Darfur.
What I saw in Darfur
The most striking thing is the absolute fear of the people there and the distrust they have. I spent an awful lot of my time in the displaced camps, which are holding at least 2 million people now across Darfur. The biggest of those, Kalma, is in a city called Niala, and it holds about 95,000 people. And the people there, some of them have been there for 2 years now, and they're absolutely terrified to leave, even if they just leave to go and fetch firewood, which is one of the things they need to do for basic survival. They face constant threat of attack. In fact, one day when I was there, I actually witnessed an attempted attack from a distance while I was at Kalma. They can't possibly think of going back to the farming villages or where they were run out from, because there's no security on the ground. And even with this peace agreement, I think the news we're getting from there is there's just this deep skepticism among the people. Their attitude is, we're not leaving until we have absolute guarantees that it's going to be safe for us to leave.
Talk about the attack you witnessed.
Well, what happened was I was standing on the edge of Kalma camp waiting for the women who go out to fetch firewood each day to come back. I was with a photographer, and we wanted to take pictures of these women and speak to them. And we noticed in the distance, what looked like some big dust clouds quite a ways out in the desert. And I was kind of curious as to what was happening. The women started to come back. A lot of them weren't carrying firewood, which was the first sign that something was amiss. And they started telling us through my translator that when they had gotten out there a few miles to get the firewood, a bunch of men on camels with guns, the so-called Janjaweed militia, had been there waiting for them. And the women had spotted them, and they'd scattered, and, you know, it had been quite chaotic. The women all managed to get away. But it was just another... The fact that this happened in full view of the International African Union troops who were there monitoring the situation, it was just a sign of how bold these attackers are, and how little intimidation they feel, even in the presence of the African Union troops.
Explain who these Janjaweed, these attackers, these militia are.
Well, that depends on whom you ask. If you ask the Sudanese government, they'll tell you that the Janjaweed, which translates loosely in Arabic to armed men on camels, are independent thugs over whom they have no control. However, UN investigators and others on the ground there who have been looking into this for the last 3 years say that the Janjaweed are, for the most part, a militia that has been drawn from Arab tribes in the region. They say that the government essentially recruited these guys to fight on their side when the war in Darfur began, because the government needed to bolster its forces on the ground there. The allegation is that in return for fighting alongside government soldiers and for essentially fighting the government's war down there, the Janjaweed are given freedom to loot, rape, and murder with impunity.
And you wrote yesterday in the series that you've begun that continues today in Newsday about the issue of rape and rape being used as a tool of war.
Yes, rape is considered at this point one of the most prolific weapons of war being used down there. I mean, it's not new that rape is used as a weapon of war, but in an environment like Darfur, it's particularly devastating. This is a Muslim society where, you know, a woman who has had sex outside of marriage is often a social outcast. Sometimes her own family will cast her out, as will her society. And for that reason, rape is actually considered an effective tool if you are trying to wage a campaign of ethnic cleansing or genocide, because not only can the rapists impregnate their victims and disturb the bloodline, but they can also render these women unfit in society's views for marriage and children, hence actually diminishing the population of the non-Arab tribes there.
We're talking to Tina Sussman, who is a reporter for Newsday, has just returned from 5 weeks in Sudan. When we come back, she'll stay with us, and we'll be joined by two representatives of two different groups from Darfur. One has signed on to the peace agreement, one has not. Stay with us.
The United Nations has called it one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. More than 1 million people in the Darfur region of Western Sudan have been forced from their homes.
A lot of them have lost. lost everything that they have.
The destruction is total. There's nothing left for the people who flee these attacks to return to.
The humanitarian crisis in this war-torn country is far from over.
Village after village has been destroyed. And when I say destroyed, I mean razed to the ground. These are huts, straw huts, which can be destroyed very easily. And all that remained were little round circles on the earth.
There's famine, lack of shelter, lack of sanitation, and lack of adequate supply.
There is no longer any agricultural production. 3 million people in need of food.
Disease is also a great concern. Many children are dying of preventable causes.
There have been no arrests, no prosecution for crimes that have been committed by armed militia and in some cases by disability.
Akoya Afrobeat Ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, low-power FM, community and college radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. As we continue our discussion on Sudan and the Darfur, we are joined by two guests in Washington, D.C. Adam El Noor Mohammed is the Secretary of Public Service for the Sudan Liberation Movement, known as the SLM. The SLM is split now into two factions, one which signed the May 5th peace accord and one which rejected the deal. Adam El Noor represents the faction that signed the deal. We're also joined by Abdullahi Eltam, who is in charge of strategy and planning for the justice and equality movement, known as JEM. They are one of the main rebel groups that oppose the peace deal. We will begin with you. Abdullahi Eltam, why did you reject the peace accord?
Good morning to we have rejected the peace accord or proposed peace accord because we do not think that this is the document is a product of a negotiated settlement. In fact, we think that this product, this document is a product of intimidation, bullying, and diplomatic terrorism. It does not really reflect our own point of view. We have negotiated for about perhaps 5 months, and that is only in the last round. But when the document came, it came completely different. It is tilted towards the government side. In fact, surprisingly, the document puts the same government, which has perpetuated all the problems which are people talk about, from genocide, war crimes, grave human rights. The same government is now put in power, and it has been given the control, the absolute control over everything, right from the lowest level up to the upper level. And that is one of our main reservations about accepting the document here. Even at the level of local government here, the government still has the absolute majority. You move up also at the level of the region, the government still has the absolute majority. You move up at the level of the national parliament, and at the highest level, that is the presidential office, is still the same government which has been accused of all the crimes, which the world now has acknowledged and learned very well, and of course denounced. It is going to be in charge of the implementation of whatever is being proposed to us as a peace agreement. There are certain things which we regard as quite essential. Any agreement which you can talk about as a sustainable has to be, of course, acceptable to all parties. This one, of course, failed that test. We are three groups. There are two branches of the SLM and one a separate one, which is JEM, Justice and Equality Movement. That is my own organization. And as you know, that only one side ratified the agreement, the rest renounced it. It's not only us who are rejecting the agreement, but even the people at every level. Yesterday, as your audience might have heard, six IDPs died yesterday rioting against the agreement.
Internally displaced people.
Yes, internally displaced people, yes. And also, of course, there are white protests at other levels in Khartoum, as well as in the major cities of Darfur. So the proposed agreement is summarily rejected throughout. However, the proposed document also lacks essentials which could make it a successful agreement. It lacks time frame, lacks implementation modalities.
Well, let me go to Adam El-Nour Mohammed.
Yes.
You're with the Sudan Liberation Movement. You have signed on to the agreement. Why?
Since Democracy Now! Are now in Washington and want to say that we are signing the agreement because we know that it is not include all our expectations or our demand. And we know the struggle is not start in 30 April. I think we are in about 5 years we are fighting the government and the Janjaweed, and you know that the suffering now in the camps of IDPs and refugees is increased, and it was been in different ways, and all the people need the peace. And we are also know that this peace is weak, but we support it by our will. And the implementation is supposed to be completely, and also international community promised us to support the peace and to make development in our region. And I think the coming days is may promised for new stage of our struggle from war to peace.
These issues that Abdullahi Al-Tam of Jem has raised, of there not being a timetable, of the government still being in power and controlling the legislature.
We hope our friends in Jem and Al-Nour function to sign, and let us together to struggle. And the elections also is near, and to organize ourselves well this time, and to find ourselves in among our people. That they are suffering, they really, the people in Darfur suffering, and the donors may not continue to bring relief to the camps, and they said that, I think, before the World Food, World Food Program now also said to us we are not going to continue the relief among the people suffering, and we must also to evaluate the situation, the general situation, our people dying. And this genocide is continuing. We want to stop
Nour
it.
Mohammed,
yes.
Let me ask you, what happened to the last peace agreement in 2004? Why did that fall apart?
2004, we signed ceasefire for humanitarian issues. But I think that agreement is very, very weak and concise on ceasefire only, not the power sharing and wealth sharing. And of course, the agreements is not the main purpose. The main purpose is how to keep this peace and stop the killing and looting things of the poor people, the rape. These are the main issues. The international community must to put more pressure on the government and on the Janjaweed to disarm them. This is very, very important.
Abdullahi Eltham of JEM, yes. The U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan said today in rich nations must provide immediate funding for the African Union mission in Darfur to ensure the success of the peace deal to end 3 years of war in Darfur. One of three Darfur rebel factions in Sudanese government signed the peace accord, as you know, on May 5th in Abuja, Nigeria. You were there. You were negotiating, though your group has not signed on. News of the agreement, as you pointed out, has sparked violent protests. Annan said that the peace in Darfur is fragile, that there's no time to lose. He said the only guarantor of security there, the African Union mission in Sudan, needs immediate help. Do you agree?
Well, the African Union, of course, has not been successful in maintaining peace, and that is why alternatives has been sought. And the records are very clear in front of you. So from that angle, yes, we are cooperating with the African Union, but we know that, well, we have to prepare for a different scenario in which perhaps the United Nations will be, I suppose, assisting in the maintenance of peace in the area. But I would like to go back to one point which you raised earlier, that why did the ceasefire fail? The first agreement you referred to, 2004, it failed simply because this is essentially a political problem. You cannot ignore the political side and expect that by tampering with the security side that the problem would be over. That is the main problem. The government of Sudan, of course, continued violating the ceasefire throughout, but also saw some members of the rebel movement. And that is because the political side is not dealt with. And here we are moving into the same scenario also. And when I mentioned earlier that things have gone wrong and we are likely to go into a situation of a missed opportunity. The American ambassador, in one of the last meetings, perhaps the 30th or 29th of April, came and declared that the security arrangement is within the national interest of the United States, but his government is not interested in the political issues and the wealth issues. So the focus has been also again being put on the security side, which is, of course, it's a fallacy because we went into the negotiating settlement because we realized that while there is no military solution for this problem, there is a political solution now.
Abdullahi Eltham of JEM, why are you in Washington, D.C.? Why are you both from JEM and from the Sudan Liberation?
Well, we are here. We were invited by the University of Kentucky. And then, of course, we are touring around to meet some other members of our organizations, the Darfur community in various cities. And that is why we are here. And last night we had a meeting with the Darfur community in Washington.
And how do you assess the U.S. involvement with what's happening in Darfur?
The U.S. involvement?
Yes.
I think you mean in the negotiations or?
Yes, overall, both in negotiations, but also role that it's playing.
To be honest, they have not provided good leadership. They thought that by just simply bullying people, that everybody will just take a document which was presented on the basis of take it or leave it. And that is, of course, presented by the African Union to us. And the African Union said, well, you have to use it. If you want to change it, you go to the government. That is not the way you do negotiations. That is not you conduct some sort of a peace agreement that is acceptable to all parties. We expected the United States to take leadership and leave it up to its own responsibility. But it followed the same method, and it copper fastened that idea of forcing the agreement down the throat of the organization. Of course, it did not work.
We're talking to Abdullahi Eltham, who is with JEM, one of the major organizations in Darfur, major parties there. He participated in the most recent peace talks in Abuja. They have rejected the peace plan. Adam El-Nour Mohammed is also with him in Washington. He is with the Sudan Liberation Movement, which has signed on to the peace accord. Tina Sussman in our studio has just returned from Sudan. Newsday reporter is doing a series. In terms of how this breaks down, and I want to ask our guests in Washington as well, what the conflict is, how would you assess it, Tina Sussman?
The conflict is
first of all, a lot more confusing than people think, and that's the one thing that everybody down there kept explaining to me. This is a conflict that is often described as African versus Arab or black versus Arab. Essentially, it seems to be pitting the Darfur tribes, Darfur meaning homeland of the Fur being the main tribe down there. These tribes are, for the most part, sedentary farmers. They're referred to as the African tribes, against the Arabs, nomadic Arab tribes. And the reason that this conflict is confusing is because it didn't just start in 2003 like most people think. It was building up over the years. Everything from, you know, climate change, desertification in that area, droughts has had an impact. That's because those droughts tended, especially in the 80s, to drive a lot more of these Arab nomadic tribes people further into what had traditionally been the African sedentary farmer region, Darfur. And so the conflicts that erupted in full-scale war in February 2003, they'd been simmering for a number of years. They just became an official war in 2003 for a variety of reasons. When you're down there, it's not as if you can just walk down the streets and look at people and know immediately, oh, that must be an African, that must be an Arab. It's really not that simple at all. But that is still the way it is described by the people on the ground there themselves.
How would you describe it as a conflict between?
I would describe it as a conflict between, I think it has its roots just like the North-South War in Sudan. Between people who feel they've been neglected and discriminated against for decades, against the government that they feel is guilty of perpetuating that discrimination.
Abdullah Hayaltam, would you agree with that assessment of this American reporter?
I certainly do. We have a government which is, of course, dominated by the 5% who are living in the very north of Sudan, that is the northern region. And they have a specific project of Arabization of the entire area. The project included, of course, pushing the frontiers of the Arab culture. Here we have to distinguish between our Arabs in Darfur. We have no problems with them, but certain tranche of them who are now acquired the term Janjaweed, who have responded to that some sort of call, and they have taken the responsibility of pushing the those who are classified as non-Arabs away from their own lands using every conceivable method, including rape, burning of villages, destruction of properties, looting of animals, and so forth. So it is obviously true that we have been thrown into a situation where we have been divided into two groups, those who are classified as Arabs and those who are classified as Zurga, that is the term which the people use locally, which means blacks or Africans.
Given the number of people who are dying and increasingly made homeless, what will it take for you to sign on to a peace accord? And do you yourself see a timetable that this will happen in? And in terms of what's happening now in Ethiopia, the discussions that are going on?
I understand very much where you are coming from. And I also concur with my friend from the SLM that there has been too much suffering. There is too much suffering now, and the suffering has to be brought to an end. The problem is that we do not think that the present document, which is in front of us, is likely to stop that, simply because it has enabled, it has given the same government which has perpetuated the problem firm control. In order to stop the suffering, we need the people to have confidence in the peace agreement which is in front of us. And that can only be done if we, the people of Darfur, and especially the people who have raised arms, that they have been given fair participation in the running of the affairs, particularly in Darfur, whether at the very low level local government or at the regional level. That will, of course, ensure that we can work together and stop the suffering. Otherwise, I don't see the suffering stop.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We will certainly continue to follow this issue. Abdullahi Altam is a senior GEM member in charge of strategic planning and training, participated in the most recent peace talks in Abuja. We've also been joined in Washington, D.C. by Adam El-Noor Mohammed, Secretary of Public Service for the Sudan Liberation Movement, as well participated in those talks, has signed on to them. Abdullahi Altam has not. And in our New York studio, Tina Sussman, national correspondent for Newsday, just returned from Sudan, and we will link to the Newsday articles, the series that you are doing, Tina, at democracynow.org. When we come back, Greg Palast, Armed Madhouse. Stay with us.
على بيننا واشيا كذب. أو مفندا يخلق الريب ما لا واحتجب ودع الغضب. ليت هاجري يشرح السبب. كلما مشى أخجل القطب. بين عينيه والمها نسب.
Abdel Gadir Salim here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Telecom giant Verizon has been sued for giving the National Security Agency the phone records of millions of Americans. The lawsuit filed Saturday, just days after USA Today reported Verizon, Bell South, and AT&T handed over millions of phone call records to help the government build the world's largest database. While the NSA spy story continues to make headline news, BBC investigative reporter Greg Palast says the corporate media is missing the real story. He writes, quote, "The snooping into your phone bill is just the snout of the pig of a strange, lucrative link-up between the administration's Homeland Security spy network and private companies operating beyond the reach of the laws meant to protect us from our government. You can call it the privatization of the FBI, though it's better described as the creation of a private KGB. Worried about Dick Cheney listening in Sunday on your call to mom? That ain't nothing. You should be more concerned that they're linking this info to your medical records, your bill purchases, and your entire personal profile, including, not incidentally, your voting registration." Investigative reporter Greg Palast joins us in the studio right now. He has a brand new book. It's called Armed Madhouse. And the subtitle is Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy, for getting the entire subtitle without choking. There's a lot of ground to cover in the book. Yeah,
there certainly is. And right now, Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan president, who you recently met with and interviewed and we broadcast on Democracy Now!, was in Vienna offering to the poor of Europe cheap oil. Of course, the deaths continue in Iraq, both U.S. soldiers and Iraqis. We have the spy scandal that is unfolding here in the United States. Link them.
Yeah, that's why I wrote a book, because it does link the whole thing together. I mean, I just got back from meeting with Chavez, as you know, and you showed our interview a few weeks ago. He's offered the U.S. $50 a barrel oil. That's a third off of what we're paying right now. Now, you would think our president would be down at Caracas kissing Hugo Chavez's behind and saying, thank you for dropping the price of oil by a third, and let's make a deal, because Chavez wants a deal. But he's not doing that, our president, even though the high prices are costing about 1 million jobs right now. And the reason he's not is that what Chavez will not do is that Chavez will not return the money. It's not about petroleum. It's about petrodollars, as I explain in the book. In other words, when George Bush rides around with King Abdullah in his little golf cart on the Crawford Ranch, he's not trying to get Abdullah's oil. Abdullah can't drink the stuff. He's got to sell it to us in Japan. But Abdullah takes the money back when you fill up your SUV, you give your money to Saudi Arabia, the big oil companies, Saudi Arabia, but then he returns it in the form of petrodollars. And that is what is funding George Bush's mad spending spree. We have a president who's racked up $2 trillion in extra debt, you know, stone sober, apparently, and someone's got to pay for that. And basically, we're paying for it by effectively an oil tax, which is returned to us because the Gulf states and our other trading partners are now buying up $2 trillion in U.S. Treasury bonds and debt. So in other words, they're recycling the money back and paying for George Bush's spending spree on dropping inheritance, ending inheritance taxes, several wars, et cetera. Now, Hugo Chavez says, I'll give you cheap oil, not only to the poor, but to everyone. But I'm not giving you back the money. That money's going to stay in Latin America to build our nations. And he just withdrew $20 billion out of the U.S. Federal Reserve. You have to understand, this is a punch in the face of the U.S. administration, far more than withholding oil, withholding and withdrawing petrodollars, as I explained in the book. And that's why you have that little nice floater from balloon thrown out by Reverend Robertson, Pat Robertson, saying Hugo Chavez thinks we're trying to assassinate him, and I think we ought to just go and do it, because they have got to get that. It's not that they need that oil money, they need that oil money, and if they can't get it, they have to eliminate Hugo Chavez.
Is the war in Iraq a war for oil?
Is the war for Iraq for oil? It's about, yes, it's about the oil, but not for the oil. In my investigations for Armed Madhouse, I ended up with a story far more fascinating, difficult than I imagined. We didn't go in to grab the oil, just the opposite. We went in to control the oil and make sure we didn't get it. It goes back to 1920 when the oil companies sat in a room in Brussels, in a hotel room, drew a red line around Iraq and said, there will be no oil coming out of that nation. They have to suppress oil coming out of Iraq. Otherwise, the price of oil will collapse and OPEC and Saudi Arabia will collapse. And so what I found, what I discovered that they're very unhappy about is a 323-page plan, which was written by Big Oil, which is the secret but official plan of the United States for Iraq's oil, written by the big oil companies out of the James Baker Institute in coordination with a secret committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. I know it sounds very conspiratorial, but this is exactly how they do it. It's quite wild. And it's all about a plan to control Iraq's oil and make sure that Iraq has a system which, quote, enhances its relationship with OPEC. In other words, the whole idea is to maintain the power of OPEC, which means maintaining the power of Saudi Arabia. And this is one of the reasons they absolutely hate Hugo Chavez, as you'll see in next week's Harper's coming out, which is basically an excerpt from the book. Hugo Chavez on June 1st is going to ask OPEC to officially recognize that he has more oil than Saudi Arabia. This is a geopolitical earthquake. And the inside documents from the U.S. Department of Energy, which we have in the book and at Harper's, say, yeah, he's got more oil than Saudi Arabia.
And is it accessible?
That's the trick. It's accessible, but the price of oil, it's heavy oil, which means it costs about, you need oil to be about $30 a barrel, less than half of what it is now. Chavez has cut a deal with me. Oil will never drop below a minimum price, but we'll get off this insane world-destroying $75 a barrel. I'll give you cheap oil, but you just put a floor under it. He shook hands with Bill Clinton on the deal, and Bush came in and spit on his hand. To say the least, he had the guy kidnapped back in 2002. Bush does not, you have to remember, he doesn't like cheap oil. When we talk about paying $3 a gallon gasoline, Bush's benefactors, donors, and his own family collects the $3 a gallon.
What do you mean?
Well, we're paying $3 a gallon. ExxonMobil is collecting $3 a gallon. There's a chapter called Trillion Dollar Babies. when Bush came in, we had oil as low as $18 a barrel. It was like water. Bush has successfully built up the price of oil from 18 bucks a barrel to over $70 a barrel. That's the mission accomplished. He didn't make a mistake here. That's the mission accomplished. ExxonMobil, which after Enron is the biggest lifetime donor to the Bush campaigns, its value of its reserves, of its oil reserves, because of the Bush wars and Bush actions, has gone up by almost exactly $1 trillion in value. Just one company, $1 trillion windfall to a single company, that's the Bush benefactors. And you have to look at where does Bush make its money. So the problem that they have now is that Chavez is trying to supplant the Saudis running OPEC. And we've got a president who basically is caught up in these guys with in the bathrobes and crowns, these dictators of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. And that's what the Bush family is linked up to, and they are not going to let them be supplanted by Chavez.
Greg Palast, when you open your book, Our Madhouse, most people have a white space there, but you use every inch, and you have a secret history of the war over oil in Iraq.
Yes,
a chronology.
Yes, I had a big fight with my capitalist pig publisher to put in this very fancy, colorful front page to give you a chronology of the complexity of these secret deals between the administration and big oil. We actually got our hands on two different plans for Iraq's oil, a 101-page plan and a 323-page plan, which is all about, in great detail, what we are going to do with Iraq's oil. And the number of Iraqis involved in writing this thing is exactly zero. You know, and, of course, the number of Americans who know that that's why we are in Iraq. And we even know from in my research for Our Madhouse, going through this and getting this document, I now know what was in the discussions between the oil companies, Ken Lay and Dick Cheney, in his bunker.
All right. What?
Well, and you'll see there they were going over the oil maps of Iraq. And the question is, why was Ken Lay, you know, the kind of Al Capone of electricity,
who's on trial right now,
is about the verdict's about to come down. Why was he in a meeting with oil companies looking over the maps of Iraq? The answer is he was on this committee drafting up the program for what to do about Iraq. And they had to get rid of Saddam because he was jerking the oil markets up and down. I was very interested, why did we go into Iraq suddenly? And the answer was he was destabilizing the oil markets. He was making it jump up, making it jump down, and he had to go. And that's right in the documentation.
Plan B?
Plan B. There are two plans. There was a neocon plan, which was 101 pages long. Now, they actually did want to break up OPEC and destroy Saudi Arabia. But the Bush family wasn't going to let that happen, nor was big oil. And you will see behind this all James Baker and, of course, Dick Cheney. You know, actually, the interesting thing, I was just realizing this morning, 4 years of investigation, Amy, you'll find in the book. You'll see all this stuff about the hugger-muggers between Cheney, big oil, Rumsfeld, Jim Baker. Nowhere is there any discussion of George Bush. He was not in the picture. He was not in the frame. Basically, there was no decision made or even discussed with George Bush. He's the president who's not there.
We're talking to Greg Palast. He has written a new book. It is called Armed Madhouse, a short title, extremely long subtitle, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and the Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Why Armed Madhouse?
That's back to the Allen Ginsberg howl, my old teacher. He said the soul should not die ungodly in an armed madhouse. It's like we have a circus of, it's like we have the asylum taken over by the inmates, and they're quite dangerous. And so we have to get out of it. So in a way, the idea is to kind of arm you with the information.
The scheme to steal 08?
Yeah. Well, for those who, you know my background, I came to the U.S. Attention when I broke a story that before the 2000 election, Jeb Bush and Katherine Harris knocked off tens of thousands of black voters off the voter rolls of Florida. And this is what gave the election to George Bush in 2000. It was fixed by knocking off these black voters. There's a chapter in the new book.
You broke this on BBC.
Yes, I broke this on BBC. And to get into the United States, we got Michael Moore to put on a chicken suit and report it here as a joke. And then thank you very much, Amy, for bringing it across the water and breaking through the electronic Berlin Wall. I mean, by the way, all these stories are stories developed out of BBC and Guardian that basically are blacked out except for here on Democracy Now. That's very important, because these are the stories that they don't want you to have for good reason. And they don't want you to have it because I then followed up with 2004. Now it's accepted that 2000 pretty much was fixed. Well, there's a chapter Kerry won. 2004 was fixed. And the way it was done is that 3.6 million votes were cast and never counted in the United States. That's very important to know. This isn't Greg Palast conspiracy nut stuff.
Say the number again.
3.6 million ballots cast, never counted. And that's because they call these spoiled votes or rejected provisional ballots, 1.9 million so-called provisional ballots, and then most of those don't get counted. And so whose votes don't get counted? If it was random, it wouldn't matter. In other words, these are votes where the machine doesn't record it properly, hanging chads, extra marks on a paper ballot, you had the wrong address on your absentee ballot, etc. 3 million ballots. Whose ballots? If you're a black person, the chance your ballot will be technically invalidated is 900% higher than if you're a white voter. Hispanic voter, 500% higher than if you're a white voter. Native Americans, it's like 2,000% higher than if you're a white voter. The overwhelming majority, and I went to the state of New Mexico, which supposedly Bush won by 5,000 votes. 89% of the ballots were cast out of minority precincts that were thrown away. Kerry won New Mexico. You go into the dumpster, and it's black votes, 155,000 black votes that were chucked away in Ohio. Kerry won those votes. He won Ohio.
08.
And 08. So what's happening is there is no fix of the system. In other words, just like black folk get bad schools and bad hospitals, they get the bad voting machines, which are going to kill those votes. But they're not satisfied with just letting the ballots be thrown away. They're going to move it along. And one of the things I discovered is the Republican Party has something called caging lists, which came to our, just like you had Friday, the way the Yes Men capture material by using false websites. So through a false website, we were able to capture Republican Party internal missives and through georgebush.org. And so what happened was is that they sent us a bunch of lists of literally tens of thousands of names of voters and addresses. We were wondering what the heck this was. It turns out these were almost all African-American voters who they were prepared to challenge in 2004, and they did, to say that these people shouldn't vote because their addresses are suspect. And you'll see in the book that in the lists of thousands of black voters that they were challenging over their address were thousands of black soldiers who were sent to Iraq. Go to Baghdad, and the Republican Party challenges your vote. And that's the beginning. And because there's been really no action taken, they're accelerating the system now. And the next thing they're going after is the Hispanic vote. So when we saw 2 million votes cast not counted in 2000. Nearly 4 million votes cast not counted in 2004. You're going to see that number massively increase and challenges to voters in 2008. And that's what's going back to this database story with the National Security Agency.
We have 30 seconds.
So you have to say, why are they collecting this data? The answer is 2008. It's ultimately all about the elections.
Well, this is part one. Greg Palast, I want to thank you for being with us. You'll be traveling around the country, and you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We will link to Greg's website, gregpalast.com. Greg Palast's book is called Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind, Left and Other Dispatchers from the Front Lines of the Class War. That does it for today's program. For a copy of the show, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Perez, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Uri Galed. You can sign up for our Daily Digest email list at democracynow.org and read the transcripts and listen and view the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.